Welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Red Seas, Ferdinand Smith, and radical black sailors in the United States and Jamaica. During the heyday of the U.S. and international labor movements in the 1930s and 1940s, Ferdinand Smith, the Jamaican-born co-founder and second-in-command of the National Maritime Union, stands out as one of the most, if not the most, powerful black labor leaders in the United States. Smith's active membership in the Communist Party, however, coupled with his bold labor radicalism and shaky immigration status, brought him under the continual surveillance of U.S. authorities, especially during the Red Scare in the 1950s. Smith was eventually deported to his homeland of Jamaica, where he continued his radical labor and political organizing until his death in 1961. Author Gerald Horn draws on Smith's life to make insightful connections between labor radicalism and the civil rights movement, demonstrating that the gains of the latter were propelled by the former and undermined by anti-communism. Moreover, Red Seas uncovers the little-known experiences of black sailors and the contribution to the struggle for labor and civil rights, the history of the Communist Party and its black members, and the significant dimension of Jamaican labor and political radicalism. And I want to say one thing about Gerald Horn, a friend of ours who is a wonderful historian and author himself. William Lauren Katz said, "Oh, wonderful, you're going to be speaking with Gerald Horn. He's a national treasure." And when I said that to Gerald Horn, he said, "He's not that old yet." And with that, one of the truly prolific authors and one of the studious analysts of our movement, Gerald Horn, with his new book, Red Seas, Ferdinand Smith and Radical Black Sailors in the United States and Jamaica. And it's a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You're a national treasure.
Oh, please.
Or you will be.
Oh, well, maybe.
So why did you pick this topic? Frankly, I had never heard, and maybe that's the reason you did it, of Ferdinand Smith, and I'm really raring to hear more because Mimi got the book and I didn't.
Well, I selected this topic for a number of reasons. Number one, I wanted to shed some light on one of the age-old controversies in terms of labor history, which is the controversy concerning communist and labor. Oftentimes it's suggested that when communists were dominating certain unions, that there was a lack of democracy. And I wanted to explore that thesis. And of course, what I found is when people like Ferdinand Smith, a card-carrying member of the Communist Party, were high up in the hierarchy of the National Maritime Union, a union that he helped to found, you found that the union newspaper, for example, ventilated all manner of different ideas and opinions. But after they were ousted and the anti-communists took over, the newspaper took on the sort of a homogeneous sheen that characterizes, I'm afraid, all too many union newspapers and union publications in the United States today. Also, I wanted to make a commentary or say something about Jamaica. Jamaica is a small Caribbean nation that has made a mighty contribution to U.S. history and to, in fact, global culture. I'm afraid that most people in this country, when they think of Jamaica, they think of, say, Colin Powell, the Jamaican-American who rose to the highest levels of the U.S. State Department. But, of course, many do not think of, say, Ferdinand Smith, for example, who was one of the most powerful leaders in this country. Certainly, I think you can compare him with A. Philip Randolph of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, who oftentimes carries the title of a top black labor leader. But if you look at Ferdinand Smith, you'll find that, number one, he was commanding a union that was not majority black. In fact, the black membership of the National Maritime Union was probably about 10%, unlike the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, which had a black membership of probably closer to 85 or 90%. And then second of all, the National Maritime Union was a powerful union. This was a union that basically had a stranglehold in turn on imports and exports into the United States. This is a union that in the heyday of its era, in 1946, was contemplating a global strike, that is to say, a strike involving sailors and stevedores, not only in the United States, but globally. And of course, this would have rocked the foundations of global capitalism at a time that it was gearing up for the Red Scare and anti-communism and McCarthyism and all the rest. So these were some of the reasons that I tackled this topic.
I'm always looking at that conjuncture, that overlay between, and I see it as an overlay, between race and class rather than as it's generally seen, which is a kind of bifurcation, which has supremacy. And in many ways, this book really helped me understand and provides, I wouldn't say a prototype, but ideas for the need and the coming together of the issues of race and class. And I was interested in how that occurred for Smith, the attraction to Smith of the communist ideology and so on.
Well, I think you have to, first of all, keep in mind that we're talking about sailors. Historically, sailors have been, if you like, the intellectuals of the labor movement. This is for many reasons. Number one, they are more cosmopolitan. As a result of their very labor, they're traveling all over the world. They're exposed to many different cultures from all over the world, so it's very easy for them to be open-minded. Number two, despite the rather harsh and atrocious labor conditions they were often subjected to, they oftentimes had a lot of time to read. They were oftentimes on the open sea for hours and days at a time. And when they were not toiling, they had a lot of time to read, and of course, they also had time to share opinions with their co-workers. Which brings us to the third point, which is that a ship is something of a isolated floating community. Unlike workers who are subjected to various kinds of ideological strains in their neighborhood or in the workplace, on the sea, you're basically, in a sense, susceptible to being influenced more so by your co-workers. And I think that that helps to explain also the kind of radicalism that Ferdinand Smith was able to be attracted to. And this brings me to the final point, which is that historically, for various reasons in the United States, merchant sailors has been an occupation that has attracted the best and the brightest of African Americans. This was particularly true in the 19th century when the merchant sailor labor force was so heavily black that many people thought that the United States was a predominantly black country based upon the fact that many of the sailors, if not most of the sailors sailing into their ports, were of African extraction. And this is one of the reasons why Ferdinand Smith was able to rise to the highest level in the Sailors Union, even before Ferdinand Smith and the rather non-too-progressive predecessor of the National Maritime Union. They also had a black Jamaican labor leader in the highest ranks. I'm speaking of David Grange, who I talk about at some length in the book. So the whole question of merchant sailors is a very unique and peculiar one. And this may help to shed light on the fact why, since the heyday of Ferdinand Smith, the merchant sailors' ranks of this country have shrunk dramatically. It's almost as if the U.S. ruling elite decided to burn down the house to roast the pig. That is to say that they were so intimidated and so frightened by the kind of radicalism that had grown up in the ranks of merchant sailors, they had decided to basically shrink that entire industry. And so therefore you have the so-called flags of convenience, where U.S. ships are now registered in Panama and Liberia, and U.S. and other sailors of various nationalities are paid paltry wages, and the ships are like floating slums. In a sense, the industry has reverted back to the bad old days of the 1920s.
I'm interested, especially in the context of what's happening in the union movement today, to talk more about the alternative, the kind of unionism, the kind of radical unionism that you're talking about. What was so radical about the NMU, I guess, after the 36-37 strike until they were hounded out of the labor movement in the Reds? What were they doing that was so dangerous?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with internationalism. I mean, for example, in pre-revolutionary Cuba, they basically set up something of a regional office that was something of a switching point for hemispheric radicalism. That is to say, their radicalism was not only confined to the shores of the United States, but had a hemispheric cast. Likewise, of course, they had, I guess, what you could call satellite offices transnationally. I've already made reference to their attempt to engage in a global job action in 1946, 1947. I think also radical for its time was its anti-Jim Crow, anti-racism efforts, premature affirmative action, if you like, that led to Ferdinand Smith not being an isolated black labor leader, but being a black labor leader amongst other black labor leaders. I think of Hugh Mulzac, for example, who, of course, hails from St. Vincent. You might be familiar with his daughter, Una Mulzac, who, of course, for the longest has been operating a Liberation bookstore up in Harlem. Hugh Mulzac, of course, was a leader of the National Maritime Union, and there are many more Hugh Mulzacs and Ferdinand Smiths within the ranks. And I think that because of their radicalism and their high-level positions in the Union, they were able to transmit these ideas directly into the bloodstream of the civil rights movement. And indeed, as I try to argue in the book, the civil rights movement, of course, brought many gains, but in a certain sense, we haven't tallied up the losses. What I mean is that in some ways, what happened with the civil rights movement is that the Deep South caught up with the West and Northeast that was basically standing still. But another thing that happened with the civil rights movement is that on the one hand, there was an advance on the so-called race front. That is to say, you could now be allowed to sit at a lunch counter or go to a hotel where before you were deprived of this on the basis of skin color. But the downside of it, of course, is the attack on the labor movement, as exemplified by the attack on the National Maritime Union, which basically means that you have lagging wages and atrocious working conditions at the same time that rights are being granted. You see an analog, in fact, with what's happening in South Africa, where apartheid walls have fallen at the same time that the movement to redistribute wealth has hit something of an impasse. And so, therefore, you see a lot of grumbling in South Africa as a result, just like you see a lot of anxiety and misery in Black America as a result of what's happened with the civil rights movement.
One of the things that's been very interesting to me is to look at the political evolution of Ferdinand Smith and the migration of ideas from Jamaica to here, since many times within our rather parochial knowledge of the world, we look at the ideas kind of percolating up from the soil proper. There were ideas that were brought over. There were ideas about organizing, about labor. And I was hoping you could expound on that and of course, why so many Black sailors, why the National Maritime Union, was it also one of the few venues available to Blacks, like certainly Pullman Porters were available to Blacks?
Oh, absolutely. As you probably know, even before the era of Ferdinand Smith, you had Frederick Douglass, for example, the Tribune of Black America in the 19th century, who, of course, was a sailor. In fact, when he escapes from south to north, he's basically dressed in the outfit of a sailor. And this is not surprising because, as I've already noted, there was a significant and disproportionate percentage of the Black maritime labor force that were sailors. Langston Hughes, the Bard of Harlem, worked as a sailor for a while. Ralph Ellison, for example, did some of his early writing on board ship. Kwame Nkrumah, the first leader of independent Ghana, actually worked as a sailor in the United States. The maritime labor force traditionally had attracted workers from not only across the country, but from across the world. And this is particularly true of the English-speaking Caribbean. And when we talk about the English-speaking Caribbean, we have to recognize that this is a region that has historically had a heavy social democratic influence. Look at Jamaica, for example, with the PNP, the People's National Party, under Michael Manley, and before him Norman Washington Manley, which, of course, has been a premier social democratic party in the Western Hemisphere. Or look at Barbados, for example, a small island in the English-speaking Caribbean of no more than 285,000 people, but has two parties, each of which has labor in the title, which, of course, suggests the importance of the organized working class within the ranks of politics in Barbados. And I think you can say the same holds true for throughout what it was once known as the British West Indies. For example, Guyana, the only English-speaking country in South America, on the northern coast of South America, which, of course, under the People's Progressive Party, a communist party, if you like, basically spearheaded radicalism and politics in the region, beginning with its coming to power in 1953 and then being toppled after about 100 days in power by the invasion of British forces, precisely because of its radicalism. So just as we recognize today that the migration northward from Mexico is bringing with it a radical ideas from Spanish speakers who are much more influenced and susceptible to the ideas coming out of the Cuban Revolution, likewise, the migration from the British West Indies, as it was once called, also brought with it, particularly in the 1930s and 1940s, radical social democratic pro-labor ideas that had a profound and progressive influence on the U.S. labor movement.
In the context of the post-war period, there was a massive strike wave, after World War II in the United States. But you mentioned something that I didn't know about, the possibility or what happened with a global strike of the maritime workers. What were the demands of the maritime workers at that point, and what happened?
The demands were many. Some of the demands were typical, that is to say, better wages. As the National Maritime Union saw it, the shipping industry was gorging on obscene super profits, and they felt that workers should get their fair share. Despite the rather Herculean labors of the NMU, there was still rather unfortunate the working conditions on board many ships. And of course, they felt that they could leverage their 90,000 strong membership here in the United States on behalf of other unions transnationally, globally, because as they saw it, if they did not move to lift the wages and working conditions of sailors in other countries, the inevitable would happen. That is to say, their members would be laid off, and the shipping industry would then begin to fly flags of convenience, which is precisely what happened. Also what happened, of course, with regard to the strike, is that it got ensnared in a bout of anti-communism and premature red baiting. Joseph Curran was the top leader of the National Maritime Union. He was once so close to the Communist Party that many people suspected that he was a communist himself. More than once, he was called before congressional panels and was queried about his alleged supposed Communist Party membership. At one time, they even brought out a membership card that they said had been signed by him. He denied vehemently that he was a communist, and he was probably correct. But in any case, in 1946, he sensed which way the winds were blowing. He broke up the Committee on Maritime Union, which was a formation that was led by the NMU and also West Coast Longshore under the Australian migrant Harry Bridges. And as a result of this CMU being broken up, this attempt at a global strike died a premature death. And shortly after that, of course, Ferdinand Smith himself came under a rather vigorous assault by the U.S. immigration authorities. And in 1951, he was dispatched unceremoniously back to his homeland in Jamaica, where, of course, he goes on to become a leader of the Jamaican left, working with his comrade Richard Hart, a historic figure in his own right. And, of course, he challenged both Alexander Bustamante of the Jamaican right and Norman Washington Manley of the Jamaican Social Democrats for leadership in the emerging Jamaican nation.
I can't help but take us full sail to today. And I was wondering if you look at the global strike in the maritime in the context of what at least there's a professed interest in doing, of beginning to look at attempts at international cross-border organizing. Do you see any parallels or relationships?
Certainly. I mean, it's long past time for the U.S. labor movement to be looking abroad, because certainly their antagonists across the bargaining table have long since looked abroad and have gathered momentum from abroad that they then use to steamroller us at home. And certainly transnational organizing is long overdue. You know, of course, that David Bacon, the progressive journalist, in his book on Mexico and the United States and the impact of NAFTA, the book entitled The Children of NAFTA, he talks about cross-border organizing in terms of the maquiladoras that line the 2,000-mile-long border separating Mexico and the United States, where it only makes good sense for workers in the United States and Mexico to join hands because, of course, they're oftentimes facing the same kind of boss.
Before we close, I would like to give our listeners a taste of what happened to Ferdinand Smith and what happened to that radicalism in the trade union movement during the McCarthy period.
Well, there was a process called screening that came onto the waterfront, and where sailors and maritime workers generally had to basically display their ideological purity, if you like, in order to keep their jobs. Now, there were some unforeseen consequences of this. For example, you might know of Jack O'Dell, who, of course, went on to become a close advisor to both Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson. But Jack O'Dell, of course, was a leader, a rank-and-file leader of the National Maritime Union, and after his being ousted, of course, went on to play a pivotal role in the civil rights movement. Likewise, Jesse Gray, who New Yorkers might be familiar with, because he was a tenant leader in Harlem and northern Manhattan, then it served a term or two in the New York State Assembly. He, too, was a rank-and-file leader of the National Maritime Union. Frank Ferdinand Smith, of course, goes on to Jamaica, where, as I've already noted, he plays a role in organizing sugar workers, becoming a leader of an important labor federation in Jamaica. He also served a term with the World Federation of Trade Unions, and he was trying to organize workers in the British West Indies generally. But, of course, because London would not allow him to have visas to enter places like Trinidad and Barbados. His plans basically did not work out as he had contemplated. He also had planned to do labor organizing in West Africa as well. But once again, because of colonialism, he couldn't get visas, and that's one of the reasons why he settled in Jamaica, where he died in August 1961.
We haven't even skimmed the surface of Red Seas. You know, one of the measures, I think, of a brilliant literary work is when you not only delve deep into it and learn tremendously from it, but when it stimulates all kinds of thoughts and gives you something to apply to the areas that you are working in. And this book absolutely does. I'm about halfway through it and eager to continue. And it also, I have to say, has one of the most beautiful graphic covers I've ever seen. And we are speaking about Red Seas, Ferdinand Smith and the Radical Black Sailors in the United States and Jamaica with Gerald Horn. And of course, I would not only encourage you to read this book, but there are numerous other books that Gerald has authored that really delve into and provide that kind of base of theory, history to be applicable to a sense of activism and really meld theory and practice together. Gerald Horn, it's an extraordinary, important piece of work, and it shows me how far we have to go in terms of even those of us who think we've studied certain issues well. It's amazing how little we know and how far we have to go to recapture our history.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me onto your program.
And you can thank the young person in the background as well.
I didn't know you wanted to hear that.
Well, and by the way, we would be remiss if we didn't say that the book is published by NYU Press. The author, of course, is Gerald Horn. The book is Red Seas, S-E-A-S, Ferdinand Smith and the Radical Black Sailors in the United States and Jamaica, and we'll be talking with you again soon. Thank you, Gerald.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Union.
Yeah, well, word up.
Scandalo.
Bomba.
Yo, 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 yo. Yo, the sound came to be a continuity from the ashes of the old. This wisdom is cold, brothers and sisters. It's time to look around. If we don't come master, we'll be driven to the ground.
It's a new millennium, new piece of history. All the workers come together with time.
This has been a Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report special, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And for more labor news and views, go to www.buildingbridgesradio.org. That's www.buildingbridgesradio.org for archived Building Bridges labor shows.
Brain and muscle, not a single will could turn. Not a force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one. Solidarity forever, the union makes us strong. All working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever. All working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever. All working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever. All working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever.
Yes, we kick it on the real, make it so the people feel inspiration, driving all the nation and exploitation. Yes, we gotta pull together, brothers and sisters. Yo, it's time for coordination.
Through our sisters and the brothers, we can make our union strong. For respect and equal value, we have done without too long. We no longer have to tolerate injustices and wrong. Solidarity forever, yes, the union makes us strong.
We're the ones who run the show, just let everybody know. With our brains and our muscle, this is how we get hustle. Solidarity forever, kick it to the people. Always keep it real, yes, always keep it simple. There's no time for politicking, the clock keeps on ticking. We have to organize, open our eyes. It's time to see the truth, it's reality. We have to make it solid, it's time for unity. Taking on 2 million that they never worked to earn. But without a brain and muscle, not a single will could turn. Not a force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one. Solidarity forever, the union makes us strong. All working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever. All working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever. Forever, all working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever. All working people, it's time to come together. A union makes us strong, solidarity forever. Forever.